Welcome, everybody. So good to see you all. Welcome to our first Compassion Dialogue presented by the Spiritual Companion Trust and the UK Register for Spiritual Caregivers. I'm very excited to be here. I'm one of the organizers. My name is Sohini. And if you are in gallery view, you can look around at all the people who are here with us as we get ready for our first dialogue between William and Robert today. I invite you to take a few moments to just rest into your heart and take a few soft breaths as we look at each other and be present. I'm also going to be the person who's going to be looking at the chat box. So if you have questions at any time, please post them in the chat box. And also towards the end of the session, we will be having an open Q&A. So if you post your questions, I will pass them on to Robert and William. Once again, I'm very excited to see you all. Thank you for being here for our first conversation. William? Passing it on to you now.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Lovely to see you. Nice to see some of you waving back. So some thanks, first of all. Big, big thank you, of course, to Robert for being here for the first of these dialogues. Big thank you to Sohini, who in the background has been organizing all this. And a big thank you to Scott as well, who is doing the tech in the background. Great service, thank you. Here's Robert with us this evening, or maybe this morning, depending on where you are on the planet. And Robert, as you know, has written many wonderful, helpful books and developed many helpful and wonderful projects. And if you want to find out more about him, just Google Robert Holden or go to robertholden.com and you'll see what's available at the moment. But Robert, hi. First of all, tell us, what kind of day have you had?
William, thank you very much for inviting me, firstly, to be part of this dialogue. And every time we speak together, I always feel it's like a living conversation. So it's exciting to me to see where it goes today. So thank you for that. And it's for me, it's evening. So where are we now? We're at 6:30, towards the end of the day. And I know I can hear the children downstairs. They're like bath time and lots of lovely background noises going on. So after this, we'll have a little bit of dinner together. And yeah, it's all very lovely. Thank you.
How old are the children, Robert?
So my daughter, Bo, she says she's 14. I don't believe her. I need to check her birth certificate. I mean, because the years are going by too quickly. Yeah. But I have to trust her on it. She says she's 14, so we'll go with that. And my son, Christopher, is 11. And we were at the West Ham Liverpool game on Sunday. Okay. I think that would be a good place to start. I've supported West Ham since I was 4 years old. It's one of the reasons why I am a philosopher, because I support a football team that rarely ever win. But we went to see them play Liverpool on Sunday, and Liverpool are like the greatest team in the universe. They are full of, like, you just got to imagine the Avengers. Anyway, bottom line is West Ham beat Liverpool. So that was a miracle.
Okay, so you've pulled the rug out from under any compassion I might have had for you this evening. And I heard that you and the family had tested positive for COVID. You guys okay?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Yeah, we've all just come through COVID. It was intense, but not extreme, in the sense that we didn't have any of the extreme symptoms that you hear about, like shortness of breath or fevers or loss of smell and taste. Yeah. But it was still intense. You know, I think it was a bit scary because, you know, everybody's experience of COVID is so different, and you're never quite sure what your experience is going to be. And we found out literally the night before. We were all heading off to Findhorn for a week. So unfortunately, we didn't get to Findhorn, which was a shame. But we've come through it. Thanks, William. It's a relief to come through it. A lot of people had told me that you can't pretend to rest with COVID. You've actually got to rest. So we really, really rested, and we're now doing a sort of a slow re-entry back into the world.
So right this moment, where's your energy level? Just curious.
Yeah, back up. I would say I'm not back to like full. I did have my first proper session on the yoga mat today, and I also had a little jog around the River Thames here for a bit. Okay. I would say definitely a self-care time. For sure, absolutely. And also looking after each other, you know, like sort of making sure that like Holly could sleep for a bit, then I could sleep for a bit, and lots of sleep, you know. Yeah, thank you for asking.
Yeah, no, I was both curious and obviously a bit concerned, obviously.
Yeah, because it's been such a journey for all of us. And you know, one of the things I think with COVID has been that anybody who's had a position around COVID, I think, has been challenged on their position at one point or another. Like, there's so much mystery to this one, you know, and not least the fact that we all seem to experience it in our different ways, you know. And so that was the scary bit, was like, you know, when it was like at its most intense, you don't know, is this the most intense or will it get worse than this? So, you know, there's that sense of relief, William, that we've got through it, and hopefully we've got some good antibodies now. So, yeah.
Well, I'm glad for you. So let's move the conversation on a bit. What I would love to know, and I think would be really interesting for us, is you've made a lifestyle and a career out of entwining spirituality, positive psychology, and caring for people. And what I'm curious about in the first place is, were there things in your childhood that laid the foundation for this? And if so, what were they? I noticed you were born in Africa originally and then must have moved to the UK. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of story there of something that opened your heart or connected you that has led you on this career path.
Yeah, thank you, William. I mean, the family has everything to do with my life story. And essentially, you know, my mother experienced depression on and off for most of her life. So this was recurring bouts of depression. And this depression was, it was the sort of depression that would arrive unannounced. And you never quite knew how long the depression was going to stay for. So, you know, as a young boy, and my brother also, David, who was 4 years younger than me, you know, it might be that we'd be making breakfast and mum hadn't got out of bed. And that's when the alert would go on, like, wait a minute, is she having a lie-in or is this another visit from depression? And if it's a visit from depression, are we talking today? Are we talking a week? Are we talking about a month? Is she going to have to go back into the mental hospital?
She went into psychiatric care.
She did. And this was also at a time when, you know, a lot of times it was the treatments were electric shock therapy, where, you know, the effects were that she wouldn't even know who we were for a while. Mm. And also quite honestly, the medication. Most of mum's life, we were treating the medication as much as we were trying to treat the depression. So that was a big deal. And that's mum. Now, dad, you know, he was our rock until really our family sort of just had it was a train wreck, really. I mean, but around about the age of 14 or 15, it was really clear to all of us that my dad was drinking too much. Eventually it became clear to us that he'd always been drinking. Mum asked him to stop and he did, and then he started again. And then she asked again, would you stop? And he did, and he started again. Eventually he left home. And for the last 10 years of his life, so he died when I was 25, he was often living homeless. And so I basically, you know, the two people who, you know, I can well, I love as much as love itself. You know, we're in trouble. My mum with her depression, my dad with his alcoholism. My dad had served in the war, Second World War, which he never talked about because I think a lot of people didn't. Mm-hmm. But it's enough to say that we found out that he went down on two boats and that terrible things happened. This was off Africa. Terrible things happened.
Let me ask you, as a child then, and as a teenager, were you acting out and going the delinquent path, or did you recognize you needed to take a caring role, or were you just watching it with survival skills switched on?
Obviously the whole time I wish it wasn't happening. This all took place, by the way, the setting for this was a little village in the south of England called Littleton, where everybody seemed to fit the normal template for a life. So we were the odd ones out. And that was painful in itself. But I think the emphasis was on trying to care for mum and trying to care for dad. I had some saving graces. One of them, William, actually was cricket.
Yeah.
I was very, very lucky. So I played cricket, and I played men's cricket from the age of 11.
So you were in a men's group.
I was in a men's group. It's exactly what it was. Yeah. And most of those guys were my dad's. You know, they were helping me out, to the point that my cricket coach, who's 82 now, you know, I take him to Lord's Cricket Ground every year. And, you know, just as a thank you. Lord's Cricket Ground is where the whole game of cricket began. It's like its spiritual home of cricket. But so they were, that was really big. And the great saving grace for me as well in all of this was that I met my first spiritual mentor when I was 18 years old. And I met him when I was in Birmingham. I was at Birmingham Polytechnic. I was studying a 3-year program essentially on psychology, because I didn't know what to do with my life. It really was a full-time job looking after mum and dad, or trying to. You know, I've still got letters that I would write to social services pleading to take dad in, because dad, you know, when you live homeless, it's really tough. The safest place to live is actually in the graveyards, because people are too scared to go. But if you sleep on the streets, there's every chance you'll get beaten up by somebody, either as an act of fun or something. You know, so it was full on. When you're 15 or 16 and you can hear the rain outside and you're thinking that your dad's sleeping rough tonight, that's pretty, you know, that's not a great experience. I think I was forced into becoming a bit of a philosopher a bit early. And I did ask those big questions of life, and nobody knew what to do with those questions, except that when I met my first spiritual mentor, which was a man called Avanti. He was in the same class as me at Birmingham Polytechnic. He sat at the back of the class. He was always the last one in and the first one out. So he was in my class. He was different to the rest of us. He was referred to as a mature student because we were all 18 and he was, I think, about 24. So he wasn't just mature, he was ancient, William. I mean, you know, that 6-year gap is pretty big when you're 18. But he was an Indian man. He was a yogi. And the short story is that he introduced me to the Bhagavad Gita, to the Upanishads, to the Dhammapada, to the Tao Te Ching, but also to Hemingway, Scott Fitzgerald. And he was the one who, he was the first person to tell me that this world isn't just a physical place, it's also a state of mind. And nobody had said that to me before. And I needed to hear something like that. And so to have his support, for him to give me my first spiritual practice, for me to have a spiritual path.
What was that practice for help from? What did he give you?
Well, initially, some of it was quite classical, actually. Like, it would be like staring at a candle flame.
Yeah.
and doing some of those classic practices. He was a classic yogi. And but the point was that he was trying to, the candle flame was a symbol for the light that animates our body. So he was introducing me to the Atman. He was introducing me to the soul. And I didn't know anything about that up until that point. So it was...
Let me pause you there.
Yeah.
For someone listening, watching, who's agnostic and curious about what we're up to.
Yeah.
You suddenly introduced these words, Atman, soul.
Yeah.
Do you want to try and unpack them a little bit, or do you want us to move?
No. Yeah, I know. I think it's okay. I mean, what he was basically saying was, you know, is that you're not just your body. You have a body, but your body is like the dress code. It's what you dress up in when you accept the invitation to be a human, you know. And if you wanted to be a whale, you'd dress up as a whale. And you know, it's like, but we dress up in something that instinctively made sense to me, William, for some reason. And thank God, really, that made sense. It sat well in my body that there was more to life than what I was being shown. And that he was really like one of the first people to say, look, try and stay open. And I think that is a big deal, William. You know, one of the things I've been reflecting on recently is that, you know, the experiment at the moment for humans is to be as rational as possible. We are so rational and it's killing us. In fact, we're becoming more irrational the more rational we try to be. And if you're going to try and be rational, that means you've got to let go of the mythic realm. That means you've got to let go of the imaginal realm. That means you've got to let go of the angelic realm. This is the first time in history, and this is all from the Enlightenment, of course, where we're trying to be super rational about everything. And this was reflected in my studies. In my studies, I was studying psychology, and I was trained in psychology. There was no soul in my syllabus. Yeah, it was all persona and no psyche.
Yeah. I was reading you recently, and what you said, you were obviously you didn't like your psychology course because it only focused on pathology. It had no focus on the elements of human potential and positive psychology and the good things. It was all pathological and was a study of illness, and that pissed you off.
Well, and so, yes. So first and foremost, the psychology was only psychology and it was super rational. So it was cognitive behavioral therapy, rational emotive therapy. It was change your thinking by changing your thinking. That was the model. But on top of that, William, absolutely to your point, the work was essentially about, it was pathology, and it was a fundamentally looking at what's wrong with all of us. And whilst I understood how important that was, what Avanti, my spiritual mentor, was trying to help me to do was also to see what's right about us. So, and this really led to, you know, I created a clinic called Stress Busters. On the National Health Service. I opened it when I was 24 years old, which is quite young to do. But I was given a wonderful opportunity by the Director of Public Health within the region, who I think must have seen something with what I was about. But my Stress Busters clinic was, for the most part, initially pathology. And it was about, let's identify the problem, let's get rid of the problem, and then you'll can go away and be happy. And what I found, William, was that when you only try to identify the problem and get rid of the problem, it leaves you in a mindset of problems. You don't go away and be happy. You don't go away and be whole. It doesn't work like that. So eventually...
Let me just pause you there.
Sure.
Because there's another perspective which I'd love to explore with you. And that is, you know, what you're saying about psychology as therapy and psychology as a perspective on savage human beings, I understand completely. But in the therapeutic world, which uses all those models, there's also a deep understanding, even if you're doing CBT, right, which I gathered you were suspicious of then, and maybe not so much now, that what mattered hugely was the attitude and the presence and the focus of the actual therapist.
Yeah.
And so I want to put that into the pot, because I kind of hear you slightly dissing a whole realm of psychology, which I'm sure you don't actually mean to, but that's what...
No, I don't mean to. I'm sorry if it's come across that way. That's not the intention. Yeah. No.
But there is this thing that if the doesn't matter what the therapist actually believes and what methodology they use, and they can... If they're decent people who give positive, unconditional regard and Rogerian language to someone, that's what does the business. And the other thing I want to catch you on as well, just to explore, is I understand about the rational bit, you know, post-enlightenment, we're too rational. Yet on the other hand, it's our rationality that also allows us to step back and go, hello, is what I'm thinking appropriate? Is my pro-vax or skeptic attitude good? You know, there's a rational mind that's at work there. And Plato once said the rational mind is proof of the soul.
Well, I think it was a different definition that he was using, because he was actually referring to the intellect, I think. And that, for me, that's different to rational today.
You mean logical stuff?
If we back up, so because I think I must have miscommunicated this. I'm not saying those things were wrong. I'm saying that what I'm getting to is that they were only part of the picture. And what I needed was a bigger picture. So I needed to have a psychology that was as much about love as it was about psychology. And I needed a psychology that was as much about joy as it was about pain, as much as it was about forgiveness, as it would be, for instance, inner peace. So I was looking, I think what I was looking for was a bigger picture. And what I was presented with in my psychology training initially was more of a diagnosing model. Here's what's wrong with somebody. And the way we're going to change it is just by trying to help people change their psychology. Now, what I felt was that as a therapist, and basically after I'd studied, I did 3 years of Rogerian counseling. So that was pretty much my basis. But what I found was that people could often change their psychology when they were in my presence, but when they were left to themselves, they often just reverted back to the old psychology afterwards. So I felt there had to be something else that I needed to do to be able to care more and be more effective in my work. And what I learned after a while was that, in a sense, was that there's a world of difference between trying to heal somebody and actually just loving them. And my work shifted from trying to heal people to loving people. Now, to do that, part of the work was understanding that actually our psychology is governed not by psychology, but by our identity. I think our psychology is a mirror of who we think we are. And our identity, for a large part, is actually, I think, governed by what I call a basic fear, which is, or a basic question, which is, am I lovable or not? As a human being, am I lovable? Am I okay?
Do you think that precedes being able to love others?
I think it's all part of it simultaneously.
And I'll tell you what you're going to have to unpack for people is what you mean by loving someone. Mm-hmm. because it's kind of open to various interpretations, isn't it? I'm really curious how you would articulate it if you can.
Yeah.
And it's at one level, it's a mystery. I know. At one level, I know it's a mystery. It's a vibe. It's a presence. It's a harmonic. But we're in a talking situation.
Yes.
So how would you articulate it?
So, well, I think the first thing to say is that in my training in psychology, love was never mentioned. So the closest we got to it probably was unconditional positive regard, Carl Rogers. I remember a seminar on interpersonal attraction theory. We invent all sorts of words so as not to talk about love. And of course, I understand it's where so much of our wounding is in the word love. One of my heroes, Carl Jung, talked about everything except love. I mean, he just wouldn't go near the word. He felt it had been ruined, essentially. He did write about love in his red book, his journals.
Let me circle you home to describe what loving someone is.
You're getting
there.
Yeah, but I think it's important. You've asked me as well, just about my training and my background, and I'm trying to tell you where I got to with it.
Okay,
which is that. In essence, I wasn't going to learn about love from my psychology training. It wasn't going to come from that. So I felt I wanted to keep the inquiry alive as to what love is. And fundamentally, what I learned to do is I learned that you can ask love to tell you about love. I learned that love is intelligent and that love knows what love is. So I of myself didn't feel I knew what love was. I didn't really know how to love anybody, but I learned to, as a prayer, whenever I was with my mum, whenever I was with my dad, whenever I was with anybody, my prayer would be, I would literally address love. And I would say to love, show me how to love this person today.
You're now, sounding wonderfully, inspirationally poetic now. So the language you're using now is that of poetry and prayer. And you're also, I think, saying to us that for you, love is an actual thing. It's not a behavior, it's not an attitude, it's a thing that is there that you are talking to and being in relationship with, but you're saying it in very poetic ways. Am I unpacking you appropriately or not?
I think that the first thing is I wanted to be, if I'm going to be involved in a caring profession and I'm not allowed to talk about love, something's off here. I've got to establish the right to be able to conduct a personal inquiry into love. And that's what I was aiming for. And to do this, by the way, I had to be more like Carl Jung than Albert Ellis. So I had to be undefined. So I had to say, I'm not going to be a psychologist. I'm actually not going to be an anything. I'm not going to define myself now by a profession, because I reserve the right to conduct a personal inquiry into what love is. And I also know that in this inquiry, I am never going to be able to define love to my own personal satisfaction. And I wrote a book on this. I wrote a book called Lovability. And I said right up front, in this book, I'm not going to define love because I think love is too big to be defined. But what I can do, and what I'd stand by, William, is that I've learned to recognize the presence of love. I can't define it for you. I know I can think about it, but it's more than an idea. I know that it has an energy, but I imagine it's much more than that. I know I can feel it, but it's certainly not an emotion. But I can recognize its presence. And for me, the big aha was realizing that love is intelligent, and that actually I can ask love to show me how to care for somebody. And part of the work was, William, was learning to stop trying to heal people. And actually to love them. And I'm sorry if it doesn't sound, like we'll be able to put it into an academic paper or anything, but yeah. All I know is that on the ground, when I think, for example, in the morning, how can I love my daughter Beau today? How can I love my son Christopher today? How can I love Holly today? How can I love William today? I feel I'm in touch with something that's greater than my own psychology, which at the same time is supporting my psychology so that I can...
This is a classic mystic approach. It's what you're describing is exactly what a Christian mystic or a Muslim mystic, a Sufi, would say. And they would use other words, maybe. They might say there is a benevolence in the universe. Spirit, yeah. God, whatever you call it, is merciful, yeah. and loving and wise and intelligent. Or the Tao. The Tao is wise and intelligent and loving. And if you connect with it, intuitively, one receives a sense of how benevolence, love can be given in a co-presence way of co-presence to someone else. It's I suppose in Christian mysticism it would be called co-presence.
Yeah. I mean, if we accept that a mystic is somebody who has a direct experience and hasn't just read a book about something, if we can accept that, I love the I think it was Carl Rahner who said that that mystics aren't special people. Every person is a special type of mystic.
I buy that 100%.
Yeah, I think we've all got that within us. And that then, with that love, then I think the rational mind now has some support. And now the rational mind can be the truly beautiful thing it is because it's supported. Like the head supported by the heart, the gut supported by the heart. Like there's now a whole mind happening rather than just, a rational sense.
Let me just dive in there.
Mm-hmm.
So, in this country at the moment, and the figure went up 25% because of COVID. I mean, there are 6 to 7 million unpaid carers looking after someone. And I'm thinking of you as a young boy, and I'm thinking of all the children who look after parents, and there are moments when there's an intuitive leaning into giving care, giving love, and experiencing love in that moment.
Yeah.
Now, from a evolutionary psychologist perspective, they would say, yes, that's a mammalian instinct to look after your genetic pool.
Yeah.
From my perspective as another paid up mystic, when people ask me what I am sometimes, I say I'm a freelance mystic. I think there is a benevolence to the universe and, care assistants and nurses instinctively flow into that when they meet something in distress or suffering, right? And I think psychotherapists, CBT therapists, also when they perceive in their presence something that's suffering, there is a basic intuition to move into that flow. And at that way, what you just said, that we're all mystics, but each in our own way, I think is true.
Yeah, and I think if we can claim that, that's a great thing. In the same way that I think, we're all philosophers, and we can claim that for ourselves. You know, we shouldn't outsource this stuff to, so much. You know, we should feel comfortable with it. What I would say, you know, is that before I realized I could ask love about this, my experience of caring, like for my mum and my dad, was often burnout, sacrifice, disappointment, and just like I was failing every step of the way. So, you know, I often, you know, was in a place of despair that all of my strategies weren't working. You know, I had a plan for my mum's life, which was that she'd get better. I had a plan for my dad's life, that he would recover. You know, so my caring was, you know, heavily, there was an agenda to it, which I'm not saying it's wrong, but I had a big agenda for it, of like what my caring should result in and how it should work.
But that's so natural, isn't it? That your caring should be entwined and invested in a result.
Exactly. Yeah. And I felt that what actually happened, what happened for me was in my spiritual journey. And so I'm going to sort of give you just another like aha moment for me, which was that one day I was really thinking about my relationship with God and just actually thinking how unsatisfying the whole thing had been up until now.
How old were you when you was this, so this event?
This was around 27, 28. And I'm thinking, okay, I've been on the spiritual path for quite a while now, you know, since 18. I've been properly, you know, at times I was a proper yogi. I was meditating, I was putting the hours in, I was a professional. And, you know, it wasn't happening. And I had an awareness.
What wasn't happening?
The experience of God, really. And also the feeling that my requests weren't being answered. And so the request to feel healed, the request for a sense of being saved somehow wasn't happening. And the aha for me was at some point that I realized God has never, ever tried to heal me. And actually, all I think, if I really take back all the requests and everything, I think all that God has ever really tried to do is to love me. But I wasn't up for that. I thought I needed to be healed first, saved first, somehow helped in some way first. But it began to occur to me that maybe that's not God's image of me. My image of, if I'm going to use Christian language for a minute, my image of me was more with the original sin. God's image of me was more with the original blessing. I didn't feel blessed. I didn't know what feeling blessed was. I thought I had to be healed first. So it was when I started to think about this and to think, well, maybe the reason I don't feel like God's healing me is because God's just loving me. And I really, for somehow that landed in my nervous system, not in my mind, but in my nervous system, in a way where it was like, blimey, that might be true.
So here's the big question.
Yeah.
Did you feel loved?
Yes. Now, when I stopped asking for healing and to be fixed and to be saved, I experienced the love. And that's when I thought, hold on a minute, then maybe my goal when I'm trying to care for someone isn't to heal them, it is to love them. But how do I do that? Oh, I know, I can ask love how to do that. And on another paradigm, you know, I thought I was here to help the world be a better place. And I gave that up. I thought, no, that's not my goal. My goal isn't to help the world be a better place. My goal is to love the world. And when I shifted and made my activism, instead of trying to make the world a better place, because I looked and I thought, well, people have been trying to do that for thousands of years. The shift from trying to make the world a better place to saying, I'm going to ask to see how I can love the world. Love the world for all of its messiness. Love the world for all of its irrationality. Love the world for its attempts to be rational. Try and see if I can meet the human experience of suffering and pain and messiness with love.
So let me ask you a question about this. We've got 20 minutes left. I want to get to some the hearts of this partly. So in the decades since that flash in your late 20s, in the three decades since then, has two questions, and that they're interlinked. Has your ability to feel love, which as you say is an embodied experience, a nervous system experience, is not an intellectual experience, has your ability to feel love deepened and got better? And has your ability therefore to be present with love appropriately to situations also improved? And is this a learning process, a developmental process still? Yeah. And then when you get, we get the answer to that one, what I'm going to ask you then is, what are the most difficult bits you've had to work with in order to, in my language, melt through to improve or deepen or whatever it is? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yeah. I think initially I was in a mindset that was rather binary or dualistic, in that I'm either happy or I'm unhappy. I'm at peace or I'm not at peace. What I feel my work has been to bring in what in mysticism is sometimes called the law of three. How can I love myself when I'm happy? How can I love myself when I'm not feeling happy? How can I love myself when, you know, life feels great? How can I love myself when life doesn't feel great? So in other words, the work became to see if I can meet my whole human experience with love, including not wanting to love myself today. Yeah. You know, so like, how can I do that? And because I think what I learned was that if I can bring as much love to my suffering, you know, as I can to my joy, that's workable, that's pragmatic, that's something I can deal with, because life being what it is, you know, it's like you roll the dice and you land on another square every day.
So let me explore that, because I'm not sure I fully understand you, and I want to. When you say love yourself, how much can I love myself whether I'm happy or unhappy? Yeah. How much can I love myself whether I'm doing well or not doing well? Mm. Prior to that, we were looking at how much you felt that God loved you. So are you now mixing those two up, loving yourself and God loving you? Or are you saying that you need to love yourself before God loves you? Because one of the things I would say is, to a degree, you can always throw out of the window how much you love yourself and just surrender to God loving you. You know, how much do you let that feeling in, even when you're depressed?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm with you on that one. I think maybe sometimes self-love is, the term is a bit misleading, because it does rather sound like we've got to do it by ourselves. Yeah. And
so unpack it. How do you, this will be really helpful for people, how do you love yourself? What does that look like?
I ask love to show me how. It's because I actually, left to my own devices, you know, it's the normal things like chocolate and stuff, you know, and a bubble bath, and you know, it's just, you know, that's that. Whereas actually, I don't think we can love ourselves by ourselves. I think that's one of the reasons why self-love seems to fail as often as it does. What we have to do is we have to come back to our identity. So once again, not just psychology or behavior, but a fundamental remembering that we are blessed, that life is a celebratory event and that there is a blessing and that we're not, you know, we're not being judged by life. We judge ourselves, so then we feel judged by life, but we're not.
Is that a mental, rational remembering, or is it a feeling?
I like the models that are, I'm a big fan of like the Enneagram and various models, which are very much this idea that we process through the body, the heart, the head, and the soul. So I think it has to be like a, you know, you sort of grab it where you can. Sometimes you might feel it here, which is amazing. You know, you might think it here, rather. You might feel it here. I think you want to, it's a remembering for me. It often comes, I have a daily spiritual practice. That's my saving grace. Every day I begin with a spiritual practice. And in that practice, part of it is remembering that I think self-love at its deepest level is the awareness that we are actually made of love. So I think it is our fundamental spiritual DNA, actually. It's one of the reasons why we love so much, is because it's part of our spiritual DNA. And so it, for me, it starts there, William, really, that I have to remember each day that I'm blessed, regardless of the circumstances of the day, to remember that life loves me. Okay. That's the big thing.
So listen, we're coming into the last 15 minutes, and I want to, yep. What I'd like to build on from everything you've said is, how does everything you've just spoken about flow into, feed into you being with students, colleagues, readers, family, and the actual experience of giving compassionate care or being a loving presence? How does all that feed into that? And what are your, I've heard you say, I think it's lovely that you ask love to guide you intuitively into how to be, right?
Yep.
But what I know for a lot of folk, for example, get irritated by folk who are needy, for example, right? So they will have little practices that allow them to be more at ease with themselves as they deal with an irritating teenager, if you happen to have had that in your life at all, right? Yeah, you, what's going on inside you in the moment that fuels you to give compassionate care? How do you self-manage your way into that?
So, I mean, I think, you know, once again, like as a sort of fully paid up member of the Human Being Club, you know, it's possible for me to have, you know, any sort of experience in the day. And as a parent, I would say, you know, with parenting, there are no days off. I always find my edge every day as a parent. You know, Christopher and Beau will show me something. I was reflecting on this recently, that I used to think that there must be a moment in the day where it's time off now. And the moment I thought there was time off, that would be when Christopher would ask for something. You know, he'd ask for a glass, "Dad, will you go downstairs and get me a glass of water?" You know. And so as an example, William, you know, I learned eventually that there really isn't a time off. I had a choice. I could say there is a time off. No, I'm not going to do that for you. Or somehow, and I don't know how, but I learned to find it a bit amusing. And I just used to go, okay, do you know, I love being a dad. And, you know, I also love trying to be a loving dad. So I'll go with this. And I just understand there's no time off. And I'm all right with that. That said, you know, I do believe fully in in including yourself in love. So in that sense, there has to be that self-care, you know, that we have to include ourselves in the program, whatever the program is. And I think that's something that I didn't used to do. I've always been more of a giver than a receiver. So my work often is to make sure that I don't overgive, and also that I'm a better receiver. I would say receiving has become one of my most important spiritual practices over the years, just simply learning to receive, to the point of, William, like, if Hardy says, would you like a cup of tea? My auto used to be, no, I'm fine, thanks. But actually, damn it, maybe I do want a cup of tea. But I'm just so used to, you know what I mean? I'm so used to being the one who makes the tea that I won't receive. So as an example, I would say, like, learning to include myself in the love loop, I would say, has been really important.
So learning to receive. Learning to feel and know that you're loved by love, spirit, God.
Yeah, I think I wrote a book with Louise Hay called Life Loves You, which really was a meditation on what Western psychologists sometimes call basic trust, which, you know, it is this idea, does life even really care about us? Or is it just all rocks and space dust and a few humans running around with a few other species?
Yeah. The book where you quote Einstein, where Einstein says, is the universe friendly? And you then built on that and said, the bigger question is, how friendly am I?
Well, that was a big part of it. Absolutely. Yeah.
Listen, I'm going to start feeding in questions that are coming in on the chat box.
Yep.
Because I'm not sure exactly what your timing is, but I think you need to close off at a certain time, don't you?
I'd love to answer the questions as well.
So Joe asks, for example, can you talk about loving the disaster that she thinks the planet is heading towards?
Yeah. So, Joe, I really do feel, I mean, this is a huge, massive question. Of course it is. I'm a pragmatist. I want to find something that's going to work. And I think that, for example, when we're caught up in the loop of good and bad, good people and bad people, I hear in the whole thing about the planet is that we're not good, we're doing something bad, and in order to be good, we've got to save the planet. I don't think ethics is going to save the planet. I think love will save the planet. I think what will happen, I hope, is that at some point we will save the planet because we will cultivate a reverence and an awe for the planet. I like ethics, but for me, ethics is fundamentally, ethics is a preparation for the experience of love. Ethics without the experience of love tends to collapse on itself, and good people end up doing bad things. They set up projects to save the climate, and then amazingly, they siphon off the money and spend it somehow somewhere else. We've seen it for centuries. Ethics, as I say, are a preparation for the experience of love. Once you've experienced love, you don't have to try to be ethical after that. You simply, I think, operate from a place of reverence and awe. And instead of trying to save the planet, you're now loving the planet. And if you're loving the planet, it gets saved. So for me, that is a shift. How does that happen, Joe? I don't know. But I just do feel that for centuries, we've had people, missionaries, who apparently are going to make the world a better place. And look what's happened. You know, look what's happened, you know, when missionaries have gone into new countries and new continents, and look what they've done to the indigenous people. They apparently were the better people trying to do something good there. They weren't loving the indigenous people. That wasn't love. That was trying to make something better. And I think making something better is fundamentally a judgment paradigm, whereas a love paradigm somehow transforms this. So in the work that I do in leadership, my work is always about, as a leader, how can I be the most loving person in this conversation today? As a leader, how can I be the most loving person in the room today? How can I make sure that I am the presence of love, that I'm being guided by love? And working that way, I have found to be inspirational in its moments. And I think that ultimately, I think the world will be saved not by people who are trying to save the world so much as by people who love the world. And it will be many, many acts of love that will do it.
That's very beautiful and helpful, Robert. I'm going to ask Sahini, who's been following the chat and the questions that have been coming in, to join us now and tell us, what question do you think Robert should address, Sahini?
Well, there's one here that is from Naomi. Is love and forgiveness the same thing? What is forgiveness? What have we not, you know, what have we not really explored with it?
I think that forgiveness gives us every chance to stay with love for the long run. I think we all set out wanting to be loving people. But we also, all of us, experience trauma. We all of us experience woundedness. Anybody who's had a past has something to forgive. And if we don't forgive it, I think it becomes difficult to love. Difficult to love ourselves, difficult to love each other. So forgiveness is like this type of love that enables us to keep on loving. Once again, I would have to say, I'm not exactly sure how to define forgiveness for you. William, I think we've been part of a 7-day conference up at Findhorn on forgiveness. You know, I mean, by the end of 7 days of talking about forgiveness, you feel like you're just at the start of the whole thing. What I do feel is that I think it's vital for every human being on their journey to make some sense of forgiveness. And to understand once again that it isn't something we do to be good or because we should. We do it because somehow it helps us to stay with love, as I say, for the long run. And once again, this will sound maybe a little mystical, but when I need to forgive somebody, I don't know how to do that. I can talk to love about it, but I also, I talk to the angel of forgiveness. I talk to the spirit of forgiveness, and I say to forgiveness, this one's a bit too big for me. I don't know what to do with this one. Show me what to do. Once again, I think forgiveness isn't just an act. It's not just a thing. It's almost like if we're going back to Plato, it's almost like a real idea in the mind of creation. It's an archetype. You can call upon it and you can say to forgiveness, over to you, I'm your student. I need some help with this one. Show me how to do this. But we need to practice forgiveness if we're going to keep on loving and be the loving presence in the world that we most want to be.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Another question that came in, the last question is, as a CBT therapist and mindfulness yes. teacher, I try to fuse the two when I treat clients, but somebody who comes purely for CBT, what would be a helpful point to offer them more, to offer them love and self-acceptance as a way of better living?
Well, yeah. So thank you, Patricia. For me, I think William really referred to this early on, which is that it's not so much the modality that we work with, it's our presence that ultimately matters. This was one of the reasons why I felt I had to become more and more undefined, because I was being taught that it's the model that works. It's the technique that's got all the magic in it. And it's definitely part of it. But I do think that the ultimate healing happens when two or more are gathered and we are genuinely, one of us is willing to be the presence of love. So, you know, it's the presence of who we are that matters the most, Patricia. So I would say, regardless of what anybody asks for, if your intention genuinely is to love someone, you will be inspired. You will know what to say and what to do and what to offer. And hopefully people will experience that, that great love, you know, that you are able to offer that person. This is all, by the way, field work, isn't it? I mean, you know, like, I think everything that William's asked me, everything that everybody else is asking, you know, this is in the field work every day. And the only thing that really makes proper sense to me about life is our capacity to love each other. That's the, if I was to really say, is it worth being a human being? I'd probably say without love, no. With love, give it a chance. You may as well. And to me, that's why actually it's worth every day just to think about how can I be that more loving person today, and how can I let life love me today, and make that the greater inquiry ultimately.
Those are wonderful concluding words, Robert. But I want to give you an extra 2 minutes. If you've got anything you want to add on to that, just as a final couple of minutes before we close.
Let's think.
You don't have to.
Yeah, no. It's thank you for the invitation. I think the encouragement would be as much as I encourage myself, is that we are entitled to conduct this inquiry into love, into truth, into caregiving. And just what William, you've done here for us, you've invited us into a space so that we can talk. And on one level, it will look like it was just you and me talking to each other. But I guess on another level, we're all been listening to ourselves actually through this journey. And I would just say, learn to keep trusting that. I think there is a voice of love that is our true voice. And learn to recognize that voice. Don't worry about defining it. Give yourself a break. Just learn to recognize it. And the more you can recognize that voice for love, I honestly believe it will just serve you very, very well. Yeah. And I think the more of us that can do that, especially in this age, I think that's amazing work, truly, and an amazing contribution to the world as well.
I think those are beautiful words to end on. I won't say anything more. Sahini, is there anything you think needs to be tagged on here?
Yes, I would just like to thank you both for a fabulous conversation, and also to everybody that was here, all the chat conversation that's been happening. It's a wonderful way to start our compassion dialogues, and it's very exciting to be in the energy of it and to feel the love moving through. And I feel blessed. So thank you. I hope everybody else feels blessed. We are grateful for you to be here with us, and we'll be here again next month and on December 9th.
Yeah, it'll be the 14th.
It's the 14th, sorry.
14th, and it'll be Lisa Anthony. You go.
And I just wanted to wish everyone well for the rest of these conversations as well. You know, this is, these are the spaces, aren't they, that, you know, where we can do this sort of inquiry and do this work. And you've always been brilliant at that, William, always. So, but I wish you all really, really, really well on the rest of your journey.
Thank you, Robert. Listen, we Sahini and I cut across each other. It was a little bit garbled. The next Compassion Web dialogue in a month's time is with Lisa Anthony, who's head of spiritual care at Plymouth University. She has a background in hospice care and psychotherapy, and she'll have a whole angle on what pastoral care and chaplaincy looks like inside a university, inside education, looking after students, lecturers, and that whole little mini ecology that a university is. And it'll be deep and interesting as well. Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
Blessings. Go dry the children after their baths. She's too old for that. He may be still welcoming it. Lots of love to everybody. Take care.
Bye.
Blessings.